Entrepreneur Weekly interviews the brilliant leaders of today in order to provide a stepping stone of wisdom on the journey to personal business ownership. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
I am looking at the new issue of Entrepreneur. On the cover, Bar Rescues John Taffer. It says, John Taffer makes you a better leader. Check it out. Newsstands everywhere, page 34. That's the new issue. All right, so here's the question. Do you want to be a good brand citizen? What does that mean? Do you even have any idea what that means? I mean, the first time I heard it, I went, brand citizen? Well, there's a woman out there that wrote a book called Do Good, Embracing Brand Citizenship to Fuel Both Purpose and Profit. Her name is Anne Barr Thompson. She is an amazing person, named Trust Across America's 2018 Top Thought Leader in Trust. She is on the phone with us right now, also a global brand strategist. Anne, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Alan. Glad to be here.
I am so interested in what you mean when you say brand citizenship, and you're kind of the pioneer of the brand citizenship movement. Explain to people what that means, and then I'm going to ask you about the five steps to brand citizenship. What is brand citizenship?
Okay. Yeah. Brand citizenship is this five-step model, and it's something that emerged unsolicited in trend research I was conducting beginning in 2011. And more so than its five steps, it's actually an ethos that runs across an organization that helps companies align purpose and profit and deliver benefits both to individual customers and employees and stakeholders. And an aligned mode also contributes something bigger and deliver benefits to the world to help solve their employees, their customers, and their stakeholders' greater concerns about what's going on.
Hmm. And new book out, Do Good. Tell us about that for a moment.
Yeah, so Do Good goes through the five steps with some pretty clear examples, and it's a great place to learn by example from both large companies and some smaller companies that have become larger over time, so more entrepreneurs companies. In the beginning of the book, I outline a little bit of the landscape and lay the groundwork for how the model came about before diving into teaching people more about it. And then the last chapter is more of not a how-to, because the notion of brand citizenship, like anything that's about changing a corporation, is a journey. So there's not like a series of absolute how-to steps. But in chapter 9, I give people highlights of how to go about doing it. And talk a lot about how you build purpose into your organization, operating principles that align with that, and a variety of ways to help companies feel comfortable embarking on this journey, which really is a journey of change, because companies historically, or over the last few decades at least, have not aligned the notion of being socially responsible as part of a purpose in the organization with the ways they earn profit. Earlier when you and I were talking, you said people are smart, and people are smart. And people know when companies are doing good deeds that are marketing ploys or just taking advantage of a trend. So this is a way to make it real to what you're about.
When does it go from, you know, I think the reason why we start a business, large or small, because, I mean, maybe some of them start small and turn into large businesses. I mean, look at Walmart, for example. I mean, that, you know, it's like it's the biggest company or one of the biggest companies in the world. It was just a guy who had a great idea. But when does it go from being the guy with the great idea to all of a sudden he has another great idea and says, I've got to be a good brand citizen as well as making sure that my company is making profit. I have to make sure that it does good to your book, Do Good. When is that tipping point, do you think?
Well, I think that the tipping point has been happening over time, and I would just like to back up a little bit, because if you're a guy out there solving people's problems, that is the first step on this pathway. And one of the things, Walmart's a great example because it's a company I talk about a bit in the book. And Walmart is a brand people think of as a me brand, and the five steps run across what I label as a me to we continuum. So a company has to first deliver its basic promise to its customers, before customers will give it permission.
All right, hold on. I got to think about that one. I got a commercial break. The me to we, what was the word?
Me to we continuum. So it's five steps that run you across me to we.
Okay. That sounds like Star Wars talk, but I'm going to get the other side. We'll learn about it. I like the me to we continuum. It's right next to Planet Elrond. We'll be right back. We're having some fun here. Ann Barr Thompson. The new book is Do Good. Don't you want to have a company that is a good brand citizen? Well, we'll learn how today here on Entrepreneur Week. Right back. Robbing on a bank in the state of Indiana.
She's a runner, rebel, and a stunner. From them everywhere, saying... There's more Entrepreneur Weekly after these messages.
All right, well, I have the rare opportunity, once again, to interview some very, very brilliant people and learn about all kinds of fun stuff that entrepreneurs, we want to know about. I want to know more about the me to we continuum from Ann Barr Thompson. She has a brand new book out. It is called Do Good, Embracing Brand Citizenship to Fuel Both Purpose and Profit. And I'm coming back. A little thing called love here. The me to we continuum. I had to cut you off at a commercial break. My apologies. Give us a little more on the me to we continuum.
Yeah, no worries at all. So I was talking about Walmart, for example, and Walmart's a brand that actually people named as a good corporate citizen in this research I mentioned earlier, which sort of surprised us because this was 2011 and people really had no nice things to say about Walmart in 2011. And why was Walmart a good corporate citizen in people's minds? Well, it was a very different reason than a sustainability expert would say or a corporate social responsibility expert. People told us Walmart was a good corporate brand because their pricing afforded them a better lifestyle. Mm. So they trusted Walmart, and trust is step one of brand citizenship, and it's step one on the me-to-we continuum. They trusted Walmart to deliver what it promised them every time.
So trust.
So it delivered a benefit to them.
Right.
To me. So Walmart is a brand that first and foremost, I trust to deliver a benefit to me as their customer.
So to your point, trust, enrichment, responsibility, community, and contribution. Interesting that, you know, here we are, what is it, 7 years later since you were doing all this, and now with the new tax laws and what have you, didn't Walmart step up and put a couple of $1 billion in their employees' pockets with some bonuses?
They did, and it's interesting. So if we go from trust to enrichment, and enrichment is about doing things better, and we can come back to that in a minute, I'm going to jump to responsibility, which is step three. And you start seeing how we're moving from me, I trust you to deliver what you promised me, you enrich my life, and now you're being responsible. So you're starting to care about a wider audience. And the thing with responsibility and why Walmart's a great example for this is the first thing people told us that they want companies that they consider responsible to do is treat employees well and fairly. And Walmart, even though they did deliver this bonus, still has a halo, and people still come back and talk about how they don't treat employees well. So when Walmart increased its hourly wage by $1 recently, along with this tax cut and the bonuses, I tweeted about it, and I got tweets back from people, oh, but they laid off people in my area and blah, 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 blah. So Walmart has a bit of a hill still to climb to be thought of as responsible and thought of as treating employees well. The halo of when it really didn't treat its employees as well as people expected hangs over their head. And because of that, Walmart will never be recognized for the communities it benefits and the contribution it makes through fixing its supply chain by its average customer. It won't get credit for those things until it's recognized as treating its employees well and fairly. And the thing about a company like Walmart is Walmart fixes its supply chain, and it can better a country, you know,
right,
depending upon where it's sourcing its products from.
Yeah.
So Walmart's impact can be huge, but people will not give it credit to them until they first start seeing them treating people closer to home. So you start seeing how that spans from delivering to me and bettering we.
Mm-hmm. The me to we continuum. By the way, you can find out more about Ann Barr Thompson, brandcitizenship.com on the web, brandcitizenship.com. Bruce.com. What about small companies? Because I know that, you know, I mean, it's easy to take a look at a big giant company that has done amazing, amazing things and has the money to do that. But then the entrepreneurs, of course, this is an entrepreneur radio show. So What about small companies? Give me in 1 minute, give me one example. We'll take a break and come back and finish some more of this.
Actually, what's interesting is we have a lot of companies that have started out small and have built purpose into who they are from the beginning. There's a company called Lush, which started out effectively in a hair salon in the UK with two owners that really had a mission that they wanted to build better body products for you. And actually, they started off, before they became Lush over time, they started off supplying products to the body shop. And these two owners, which you wouldn't know much about, actually helped the body shop build its policies about treating animals ethically and a variety of things like that.
I got you. So
it's
building it in from the beginning, and it's easier, for a small company. Let me take another break. We're talking with Ann Barr Thompson, brandcitizenship.com. This is all good stuff. We all need to be better brand citizens if we have companies. We'll be right back.
Discover unstoppable industry influencers who celebrate disruptive thinking and game-changing business strategies on Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
Ann Barr Thompson with us. She is the pioneer of brandcitizenship.com. It's the brand citizenship movement. She has a new book out, Do Good, Embracing Brand Citizenship to fuel both profit and purpose. I flipped those on you, by the way, because I'm looking at profit.
Okay.
It works either way, I think.
Okay. People like profit first, still.
That's right. Let's talk about these five characteristics a little bit more for earning lasting trust from customers, employees, and stakeholders. And you know what's funny? It's like, yes, the employees, if you don't have their trust, man, does that make life difficult to run a business, doesn't it? So you got to get the trust from the employees, from the customers, and of course, the bigger the business gets, the stakeholders, everybody has to be on the same page. And when you're doing good, I like your name, Do Good, by the way. It's a great name for a book, especially when it comes to the world of, you know, business and entrepreneurship. Let's continue on, though. We had trust, enrichment, responsibility, community, and contribution. Where do we leave off?
Well, we skipped a little bit about enrichment, which I'll give to you really quickly because it's an interesting one and it's one people really tend to latch on to easily. So enrichment is all about making things in our life more enjoyable. And we're talking about entrepreneurship here. And do you know Mrs. Meyers, the household cleaning product?
Yeah.
Mrs. Meyers started out as an entrepreneurial company. It actually started with another brand that was a more expensive brand. Mm. And the founder wanted to make her products more accessible to people. So Mrs. Meyers is a brand that people in my research labeled as a brand that enriches their lives. Most of its ingredients are fresh, and when they're not all natural, they admit to it. So people forgive them for it because what their products do and how they make cleaning enjoyable surpasses the fact that they may have a few ingredients that aren't 100% natural.
Right, but if you lie to them and they find out, hellfire.
That's not good.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's step one, trust. You have to build trust before you can enrich my life.
Yep.
So with Mrs. Meyers, people told us when they're using their products, they feel like they're in a French lavender field and it makes cleaning so much better and more enjoyable. Mm. So a simple product like a household cleaning product betters people's lives. And Mrs. Meyers also does a lot of things. We talked about responsibility before and having a lot to do with employees. It also has to do with how you take care of your supply chain and things like that.
Right, but wait a minute. Now, let's get back to the French lavender field. Are you sure that the woman
I'm using Mrs. Meyers to jump to
But
four.
Are you sure she wasn't snorting cocaine? Because that'll give you that same sensation. I'm joking.
But as far as I know from my research participants, they weren't sensing that. Maybe that's why they feel so good when they're cleaning.
Right.
But if we jump ahead, they are responsible with how they manage and produce their products. They're now owned by a larger company, S.C. Johnson. So S.C. Johnson is known for treating its employees fairly well. It's a family company.
Right.
And Mrs. Myers actually is amazing in terms of its community. And it does a lot of work in local communities with gardens. And you can start seeing the connection. French lavender fields, community work better in gardens. Gardens better how we interact with each other. They better how we eat. They better the air we breathe and things of that nature. So you start seeing how this company is moving across from a delivering a benefit to me and bettering we at the same time.
It's interesting to see. I'm looking, you know, at your vast amount of education that you have, is the best way to say it. And of course, you know, I like to play with people, but, and then you've taken all that education and you come back to something that is more of a heartfelt thing, this brand citizenship, and you've kind of pioneered this whole movement. And this is more of a thing, almost it seems like a thing of the heart, using all of your education and your ability to do all this study and all this research and gather data. And it comes back to something that you must be passionate about personally.
I think probably a bit of my passion about it personally was probably why I, as an entrepreneur running my own business, when this research had the first findings that indicated there was this trend going on, and that people at the end of 2011 started telling us in research that was completely about something different, that they wanted business to step in and help start fixing the problems that government wasn't fixing. And we start seeing that call bigger now. But when I first started seeing this in 2011, it was something important to me. And I took some of my personal earnings and invested a significant amount over 3 years to figure out what was really going on and why the model makes so much sense to people. And when you talk it through, you start logically understanding how the steps flow to one another, is because it came from what people told us. It wasn't developed in an ivory tower. It wasn't developed in a boardroom. It wasn't developed in a classroom. It was developed from the grassroots up based on what real people were saying they wanted.
But it's so important, too, because, I mean, you have all these analysts and all these business people that are telling you how to do your business, and they forget sometimes to make sure that they consider embracing brand citizenship, as you call it, this whole movement. By the way, everybody, again, her website, Ann Barr Thompson, is www.brandcitizenship.com. And I applaud you for this. I think it's great. It's important, especially the bigger the companies get. If they aren't responsible, if they don't love their employees and their customers and the stakeholders, then, you know, what is it all for? You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I would agree with that.
All right. And thank you so much. Keep up the good work. The new book is also Do Good. You can find it, I'm sure, at the website, brandcitizenship.com. And thank you.
Thank you.
All right. There's more here on Entrepreneur Weekly. Stay with us.
You're listening to Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
So our next guest has been living life in the fast lane, responsible as a director for a gigantic company, Procter & Gamble, for billions of dollars worth of sales. Now he is an author, a speaker, and a teacher, and he's got a new book, Find the Fire, Ignite Your Inspiration and Make Work Exciting Again. How can we do that? Well, the guy who knows is the guy who wrote the book, Scott Mautz. He's the CEO of Profound Performance. Scott, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Alan. And whenever I hear you talk, it's obvious that you're on fire and you've already found the fire. So that's pretty good. That's a good role model.
Well, that's good. That's good. You know, what's funny is you can tell a lot from a voice, can't you? And let me give you an example. I interviewed a guy, oh my gosh, it's been 25 years ago, who was this, you know, Paul Harvey kind of a guy. He wasn't Paul Harvey. I would have loved to have interviewed Paul Harvey, the king of talk radio. But this guy was like that. He was just this amazing human being. I heard him on the radio, and I reached out to him to do an interview. And you know what he says to me? He must have been, oh, man, he was like Paul Harvey. He must have been 75, 80. And I was probably 25 or maybe 30 at the time. And he says to me, young man, you'll do well in radio. I hear a smile in your voice. And I was like, wow, how do you, and I was like smiling when I was talking to him. How do you hear a smile in somebody's voice? Well, people are not dumb. They're listening. They can hear every nuance. They can hear if you're lying. They can hear if you're telling the truth. They can hear if you're sincere. They can hear if you're selling them, trying to pitch them on something. They can hear a lot more than anybody gives credit for. So that is the reason why I do my show kind of the way I do. When I'm pitching something or selling something, you guys that are listening know it. And I can't help it because I'm pretty transparent in that way. But you know what? I also have to, you know, pay the bills here, right? So, but when I'm truly being honest for a moment about my life, they also hear that. I've talked about pretty much everything under the sun in my life, Scott. I have shared things that my wife would probably be horrified if she knew that I've talked about everything. But anyway, this is really important. People can hear in your voice, and when they can see your face, they add those two and two together, and it doesn't take much to see if that is an inspired person, a motivated person, an angry person, a hateful person. You can see and tell and read so much from the voice, the facial expressions. So people, don't think other people aren't looking at you, assessing what's going on inside of you, because they are. Now we're going to come back to the book, Find the Fire, Ignite Your Inspiration. You think people lose their inspiration at some point when they've gone down the road of life and they've become bitter instead of better? And do you think there is also a way to find it again? Because that's what you find your fire. I mean, that's what your book is about. So I'll let you riff now.
Yeah, you know, one thing I did want to point out, by the way, Alan, is that, you know, while you were being told you have a smiler in your voice for radio, I've only ever been told I have a face for radio, so I am jealous already. And as to your question, you know, I wish I could tell you, Alan, I wish I could tell you that there's no need for my book and I never would have had to have written it. But the truth is, and, you know, I'm a huge research dork now, having left a massive business where I depended on data. And, you know, now I teach at Indiana University where I'm engrossed in data all the time. And I can tell you the research is really clear that, unfortunately, 70% of us would say we've lost that love and feeling, yeah, you know, that we've become uninspired at work. So the need has probably never been clear, especially as millennials enter the workforce, and what the workforce offers today often doesn't necessarily match up with what millennials are looking for. Mm. So the good news is that, you know, you absolutely can reignite your fire, and it all begins, just to start the discussion, with a really important admission, which is people need to understand that you don't wait around for lightning strikes of inspiration to happen. That's not the way it works. Most of us, you know, would say that we'll depend on our boss, you know, and the research tells us there that while 60% of us say the number one thing we want from our boss is for him or her to be really inspiring, then you ask those same people, okay, great, is your boss inspiring? 11% of them will say, well, yeah, I guess so. That's a heck of a gap. So if you're waiting around for your boss to get it done and reignite your fire and get you inspired again, it's not going to happen. Mm. You have to start with that understanding. And maybe here's the first epiphany of the day for your listeners. You got to start with the understanding that inspiration can, in fact, be codified and coaxed, and that you can create the conditions where inspiration is much more likely to occur. You don't just have to wait around for happenstance to kick in and the lightning strike to happen.
Mm. Let me ask you something. You're in this business and you're killing it. I mean, multi-billions of dollars in the business you're dealing with. And you're the guy, you're a director, you're a big guy. Why did you leave?
Great question. It really came down to one thing, Alan. I kept asking myself over and over and over again. And whenever you're going to make a choice to leave a job, I've found, and I've always counseled people, if you have too many variables, you will go nuts on the pluses and the minuses. You need to boil it down to the one thing, the one question for yourself that matters most. For me, the one question that guided me was, can I make more of an impact in people's lives by running business units, you know, with 500 people in it at a time, or by addressing crowds of 5,000 and more, like I've done recently. And when I kept coming back to that one question, Alan, how can I broaden my impact with the amount of time I've got left on this planet, whatever that might be? Only Beyonce and somebody else knows the answer to that great question. You know, how long do I have left? Whatever that is, I want to do it. I want to leverage it in the most impactful way. Once I asked that, it became clear, like, wow, I think I have this burning inside of me to have an impact in a broader way, much faster. And that's when I turned my passion to speaking from stage and writing and teaching.
You know what, Scott? Do you know what?
I'm waiting. What?
I feel good.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I'm enjoying myself listening to you. So the question is out there, can someone coax their inspiration to keep that fire burning? Scott says yes. We're going to talk with him for another 15 or 20 minutes here on Entrepreneur Weekly. You can find him at scottmautz.com. That's MAUTZ.com. Scott Mautz, Profound Performance. His new book out is called Find the Fire, Ignite Your Inspiration, and Make Work Exciting Again. This is Entrepreneur Weekly. Be right back.
Can't get enough of Entrepreneur Weekly? Check out our podcast on iTunes for even more content. Subscribe today. You're listening to Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
This man on the radio with us, Scott Mautz, CEO of Profound Performance, is he's something special, man. He pulled the parachute like us other entrepreneurs, left a company, Procter & Gamble, that he was responsible for $3 billion a year in business. Why? Because of a burning fire that he had inside that he had yet to fulfill of being an entrepreneur. Am I right in saying that, Scott?
You nailed it, baby.
Yeah.
That is right on.
So the question I have is, you know, looking at your job, you might say, you're a keynote speaker, you're a teacher, you're, you know, an author, you've done all this stuff, but you also have workshops, coaching, online training, and this is like, you know, I mean, it's interesting people that go into this that want to help others. Can I just find inside of you the day that you made that decision to pivot? Because that's an interesting day that I think so many people, like, dude, you had a huge job. You had to be making pretty good money. So it probably wasn't a money thing. It was something that was that burning fire inside of you. I mean, you even named the book, Find the Fire. Where was it? What day? Do you remember that day?
I most certainly do. And this will be great because this will give me a chance to be vulnerable with you and your listeners here. It was one particular day where, you know, we were reporting fantastic results for our business unit. It's a business unit that's just over $3 billion in sales, like you pointed out. And I noticed that, you know, I was in a meeting with some, you know, pretty powerful, high up people in the company. And I remember this feeling of still needing their approval. This constant seeking of validation from other people that, you know, I'm happy with his results. My organization is important to me. It's everything. I grew the business in the right way by bringing people along in the right way, and they would kill themselves to come and work in my shop. And I, you know, at that time it was already starting to write books, and I had everything going, yet I still felt this need inside where I always had needed validation from other people. Mm-hmm. And I remember in that moment thinking, like, man, I have got to stop seeking approval, and I've got to start chasing authenticity instead. Authenticity over approval. And I remember it dawning on me in that moment of, look, I've got to start chasing the authentic me, what's really burning inside of me, pursue the unique gifts I know I can bring the world, and stop this madness of constantly living inside a giant organization where it was meeting after meeting, result after result, all in an attempt to get approval from others. Mm. And once I realized that about myself, Alan, it became very clear that the best way to do this is to go for it, pull the parachute, like you said, get out there, do my own thing, attack my fear of failure head on, get past my need for approval and worry only about a comparison to who I was yesterday. What kind of man was I yesterday? And have I become a better version of myself versus yesterday in serving my fellow human beings? That's the day I knew I had to go for it and I had to go find my own fire.
We're talking with Scott Mautz. He's the CEO of Profound Performance, scottmautz.com. That's MAUTZ.com. It's interesting because so many people are at that place where they have a job that pays the bills. They have a wife and 2.5 kids in a nice 2.5 bedroom house, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But they just have lost their fire. They've lost their purpose. They've lost their way. And they're looking for that something different. Being an entrepreneur is a dangerous journey to take because it has a risk. Preach. And but, you know, I mean, risk, if it doesn't have risk, that's, you know, that's probably not very exciting. That's what gives it the excitement. That's the torque behind the horsepower, if I could say it like that for the car guys, because I'm a car guy. And so I think that, you know, risk is an important thing in life. And when we start forgetting about taking a little bit of risk every so often in life, the fire starts to go out and you start to become complacent and you start to become apathetic and fat and, you know, just unhappy. And then disease sets in and we've lived our life. That's when you take a perfectly good piece of fruit. It's in the fridge, but I haven't eaten it. I haven't used it yet. And all of a sudden it starts molding. I'm like, what's going on? You know what? It starts dying. It starts, you know, going back to the earth from which it came. And I think that is that fire that keeps the fruit from rotting on our, you know, because what they say, judge a man by the fruit of his life, right? That's
right.
The fire that keeps us alive is the risk taking, is the, you know, calculated risk, thoughtful risk. Like you said, data driven risk. There's always a risk. You use the data to back it up. And I think that, gosh, so many people are in the position that we're talking about right here that they have not yet taken the jump. They have not done the assessment of what should I do? Should I start a yogurt shop? Should I start a gym? I bought a gym, Scott. I had no idea what I bought a gym. Now I'm looking at it. I'm thinking, you know, and then guess what? I want to start a yogurt shop. I don't know why I bought a mall. I have a mall. I have 28 units. I want to fill the whole thing full of business. What is it about some people that are entrepreneurs that are driven by this passion to keep the fire and the flame burning? Again, his new book is called Find the Fire, Ignite Your Inspiration and Make Work Exciting Again. So if you can't ignite that fire, if you can only stay in the role that you have today, possibly this book might help you. We're going to have one more segment with you, Scott. Stay on the line. We're talking with Scott Mautz. You can find him Profound Performance at scottmautz.com. This is Entrepreneur Weekly. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. There's more Entrepreneur Weekly after these messages. Listening to Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
Well, it's all free, the advice, and it's worth exactly what you're paying for it. It's free. But here is some good advice from Scott Mautz. He's the CEO of Profound Performance. He's a lecturer, he's a teacher, he's an author of the book Find the Fire, Ignite Your Inspiration, and Make Work Exciting Again. Scott, maybe you could take a couple of minutes here before we have to say goodbye and give us some of these lessons, some of these hopefully, you know, something that will ignite that fire just a little bit. And maybe they can pick up the book and finish the rest or continue noodling at entrepreneur.com where they may be. Or if they're listening on our radio show nationally syndicated, you can go over to our website or Scott's website at scottmautz.com. So it's all yours. You got 4 minutes.
Here's something that's important for your listener to remember, Alan. For eons, we have been asking ourselves the wrong question when we feel uninspired. Research tells us that we most often ask, well, man, I'm feeling down in the dumps. You know, what inspires me? And then we try to do more of that. But the problem with that is that the answer to that question is far too passive. It's far too elusive and gets repressed by really toxic work environments. It turns out the right question to be asking is, how did I lose my inspiration in the first place?
Right.
Because let me tell you, brother, it was everywhere when you started. You might not remember anymore, but for those people that have lost their fire, you didn't have to look very hard. It was everywhere, like half-finished highway construction. It was around every quarter. You couldn't get away from it. It was everywhere. So the question to ask yourself is, how did I lose it to begin with? Because the theory is simple, Alan. Rather than dig deep wells of new inspiration, which is really hard to do, go back to the wells that have dried up and refill them. I'll give you a few examples. Here's a couple of the nastiest things that drain our inspiration. We talked a little bit about this. You know anybody, Alan, in your life that has a fear of failure? You ever met anybody that has a fear of failure?
Yeah.
Shocked if you didn't.
Right.
Especially in your space. Fear of failure is probably the biggest thing that drains our inspiration, Alan, whether you're an entrepreneur or whether you're in a corporate environment thinking about leaping, whatever the case is. It's the number one thing that half of all adults say keeps them from realizing or even revisiting their goals. And what I often tell folks, whether it's on stage or in writing or in teaching, the best way to attack fear of failure is to reframe it. You have to understand that our fear of failure really attacks the part of our brain that's responsible for risk-taking, and it shuts it down. Neuroscience actually shows that our part of the brain that's responsible for risk-taking shuts down in the face of fear of failure. So you can reframe it. For example, what if I were to tell you, Alan, there's really only three ways you can fail, man. When you quit, when you don't improve, or when you never try.
Right.
What if I were to tell you that, guess what? Failure doesn't happen to you. It happens for you. What if I were to tell you that, you know what? That little pit you feel in your stomach before you make that leap, that's not there to scare you. That's there to tell you that it must be worth it, or you wouldn't be feeling anything other than maybe indigestion or gas.
Right.
So, you know, I'm here to tell you, you can reframe your fear of failure, which is the opposite of inspiration. You can also, most people say that, boy, I feel uninspired at work when I feel a sense of insignificance. When if I was really honest with myself, I would say, I don't think what I'm doing really matters that much, not to the company, not to anyone else, and certainly not to myself. We have an opportunity to reverse that feeling of insignificance in a number of ways. I'll give just one example. Have you ever decided, Alan, that you were going to lead something that only you could lead? That you had the unique skill set to do, only you had the passion to do, only you had the resources to do, only you had the position and the job title to do. If you have, you know how significant that can make you feel and how much inspiration that can bring back into your workday.
Right.
When you decide to lead what you know you're the only one that can lead, especially when it's something that requires leading. Mm. These are just two examples of ways we can reverse the things that drain the inspiration in our life. In the book, Find the Fire, I talk about nine anti-muses, the opposite of the well-known muse that whispers in our ear to get inspiration. I talk about the nine forces that are the opposite of that, and I just talked about two of them here, fear and insignificance. Mm. I can talk more if you want.
Yeah. No, listen. I know. Well, you're going to have to come back and do it again, Scott.
Fantastic.
I think you did a great job. I think that we need more people that are helping others to make that jump of faith, that leap they need to make. The leap that I made, you know, I had one job for one day when I was 16 years old. And that was enough to make me never want to work for another person as long as I live. And I'm closing in on 60. And I ain't going to stop. Nothing's going to stop me till they pry my pin out of my dead cold fingers. All right. Find him at scottmouts.com. I'm Alan Taylor. This is Entrepreneur Weekly. We'll see you next time right here. Come back and visit. See you then.
This program is copyrighted by Entrepreneur Media Incorporated.